only a Henley. It fit so tight that I got some idea of what you must look like under it. I couldn't stop looking, imagining, and wishing I could see your bare chest.
He gave her a lopsided grin. I was wishing I could see yours, too. He palmed her breast and ran his thumb across the nipple. More than just see. He bent his head and caressed her nipple with his tongue, then sucked each into his mouth before leaning away from her. I've daydreamed for hours about doing that.
You have?
Since I saw you wrestling with that sheet. Even that saggy dress you had on couldn't keep me from wondering what was underneath. Every time the wind kicked up, I got a fairly good idea.
You gave no sign.
I thought you were married.
Have you ever been?
Married? No. There weren't any girls on the ranch except for one hand's mother, who cooked for Mr. Hobson. The girls in town were just, you know. Us cowboys made that house a stop on our alternating Saturday nights off.
She folded one arm beneath her head. You never had a special girl, Thatcher? One who either got away or who you left behind?
No.
She just looked at him.
No, he repeated.
You've never been in love?
No.
He lifted a strand of her hair off the pillow and began winding it round and round his index finger.
There was a woman in France, not one of the French girls you referred to, he said wryly. She was a nurse in the hospital. She was from Scotland. When she talked, it sounded like bells jingling.
Was she pretty?
In her way. Every soldier in the ward liked her. They'd flirt with her, she'd flirt back, all in fun. Whenever one would die, she took it hard, because she'd lost her fiancé during the first year of fighting. That's why she volunteered.
He pulled his finger from the curl of hair he'd formed, laid it back on the pillow, then began to trace the shape of her eyebrow.
She was crazy about horses, found out that I was a cowboy, wanted to know all about my life on the ranch in the Wild Wild West. Sometimes, after her shift, she'd come sit with me and we'd talk.
When he didn't continue, Laurel whispered, There's more to this story, I think.
He gave a small shrug. When I was discharged from the hospital, I was given a 3-day leave before I had to report for duty. She invited me to stay with her. She had a small place, only one room and a toilet, but she'd made it cozy.
How often did you stay with her?
Just that once. After that 3 days, we said our goodbyes.
Did you write to each other?
No.
Did you see her after the war?
No.
Did you try?
No, it wasn't like that, Laurel. She was a caring person. For all the cheers she gave her patients, she was sad, still in love with her fiancé. We were a comfort to each other, that's all. Two people trying to take some pleasure where there was damn little to be found. Those 3 days were just a time out from the hell going on around us.
Like this is now?
He quit concentrating on her eyebrow and met her gaze directly. Placing his arm around her waist, he spread his hand wide over her bottom and pulled her against him. Nothing like this. Nothing's ever been like this.
His deep kiss became a long, continual one that caused renewed arousal to spiral inside her sex. Gradually, the kiss changed character, taking on heat that melted any lingering inhibitions. Up till now, the word erotic had hinted at dark and mysterious things of which she had no experience or knowledge. Now she felt steeped in the essence of the word's definition. Thatcher ended the kiss only to whisper against her lips, I have to have you again. Her desire for him had also risen to the level of need.
Yes,
he murmured indistinctly as he moved to lie between her legs.
I'm going to kiss you.
But he didn't do as he was wont to and cradle her face in his hands. Instead, he clasped her hips between them and blazed a trail of wet kisses down the center of her body. His hands assumed mastery over her movements, but their guidance was gentle and unrushed. He repositioned her legs to accommodate his shoulders, cupped her behind the knees and raised them, stroked the backs of her thighs,
then slid his hands under her bottom. It was a delicious shock to feel the prickliness of whiskers against her navel, in the valleys under her hip bones, and on the insides of her thighs. She couldn't hear everything he whispered directly against her, but she felt the words as they formed on his lips, felt the warm breath that wafted over her sensitive flesh as he spoke them. She never would have imagined that his mouth could be both softly persuasive and aggressive at the same time, but it was. His tongue was simply wicked. It shattered her, and she surrendered to it utterly. She was still in the throes of her orgasm when he braced himself above her. In a possessive push, he sheathed himself. He gave only a few more rapid thrusts before his body tensed and she felt his pulsing deep inside her. She closed around him as tightly as she could, and they held that way until they both went listless. Long moments later, he placed his hands at each side of her head and sank his fingers into her hair, tangling the strands around them as though he wanted to be ensnared. He remained heavy and full inside her, filling her. His face was feverish against her neck. His breath, which had been gusting, eventually slowed. He inhaled deeply once and exhaled slowly. Before he slept, he spoke a single word. Laurel. Only that. It was enough. 56. Thatcher's clothes were still damp, but he had no choice except to put them back on. He was moving quietly so not to waken Laurel, who was a damn tempting sight, hair streaming over her pillow, face relaxed in sleep. Her bare shoulder had escaped the covers. He thought of leaning down and kissing it, but was afraid she would wake up. She needed her sleep. Last night, after napping for a while, they'd gone downstairs to the bathroom and bathed together by the glow of a kerosene lamp. She had overcome some of her shyness and had asked delicate questions. His candid answers had made her blush. But not to be outdone by French tarts, she'd asked him to coach her on how to please him. It was he who'd wound up in thrall of her ardor and talent. They'd fallen asleep, spooning, but he'd awakened an hour later, hard with wanting her again. She purred in permissive response to his hopeful nudges. But when she tried to turn, he reached across her and spread his hand over her middle, holding her in place. Ever since that damn rooster attacked and your bottom bumped up against me. Just thinking about that slow, drowsy sex made him want to be coupled with her again. But each of them was facing a challenging day. She would be grieving Davy O'Connor and consoling his brother. Sheriff Amos was expecting him. He gave her one last longing look, then slipped out of the bedroom unheard. Fred Barker was already in his shop when Thatcher arrived to return his rifle. "Why don't you keep it?" Barker said. "After what happened last night, I reckon you might need it." "You heard about the ambush?" "Heard the ambush as it happened. Wife and me thought firecrackers were going off. This morning learned different from the milkman. That O'Connor boy was a hellraiser. I'd have locked my daughter up was he to have come anywhere near her, but being gunned down like that." Barker shook his head in sorrow. "Something's got to give around here, Thatcher. Hang on to that Springfield. It's not like it's the only rifle I have." "Thanks, I'll take good care of it." He asked Fred if he could spare Roger to do the stable chores. "Sheriff wanted me to be on hand today." Fred spat into the dirt. "He's gonna need all the men he can get. Do you believe a lightning strike caused that fire?" "Fire? Jesus, Thatcher, you ain't heard about that?" The sheriff's office was more crowded than it had been since the morning the search for Mila Driscoll was organized. Then, Thatcher had only heard the commotion from his jail cell. This morning, as he entered the building, he had to wedge himself between the interior wall and the throng of men surrounding Bill, who was standing in the center of the large room, fielding dozens of questions, even as he issued assignments. "We don't know how many confirmed dead yet," he was saying. I'm afraid to calculate. Relatives we've talked to said that Hiram had called a Klan conference. The only acceptable excuses for not attending were that you were being born or dying. There could have been dozens inside that house, including women and children. So far, we haven't come across any survivors, which leaves us knowing squat about what happened during that meeting. Thatcher listened, as did everyone else, as Bill shared what little he had learned. Hiram's nearest neighbor, with whom he wasn't on the best of terms, had heard a loud bang the night before.
"He took it for a lightning strike, rolled over, and went back to sleep. This morning, when he noticed several thin trails of smoke coming from the direction of Hiram's place, he thought he ought to go check."
When not a single Johnson appeared on their private road to challenge him for trespassing, the neighbor had become even more apprehensive of what he would find at the dead end.
"He said the house had been incinerated," Bill told those gathered around him. "Despite the rainstorm last night, parts of it were still smoldering. He drove to the nearest telephone and called me."
Bill stared down at his boots for a moment.
"All I can say is it must have been a hell of a blaze. It's a scene out of hell."
Bill had left a team of deputies there to keep curiosity seekers away. Even those few Johnsons who hadn't attended the meeting but had immediate family members who had weren't allowed beyond a certain point.
"I've requested a team of state investigators specially trained in arson to come up from Austin. Maybe tomorrow before they can gather all their gear and make the drive. In the meantime, the rest of you continue investigating the ambush on the O'Connors. You have your duties. Get to them."
Many shuffled out. Others got on telephones. Bill came over to Thatcher, who said,
"Sorry I wasn't here earlier."
"Be glad you missed it."
"The Johnson place?"
"Thatcher, if that fire wasn't an act of God, it was the work of Satan himself. There were kids in that house. Babies."
Thatcher had seen charred bodies of soldiers on the battlefield and of civilians in bombed-out villages. He had hoped never to see such a grotesque sight again. Neither he nor Bill said anything for a moment. Then Thatcher asked if Mike O'Connor was still alive.
"Last word I got, he was holding on, but they're keeping him sedated. Doc Perkins said he'd let me know as soon as he's stable enough to be questioned."
Thatcher nodded absently, then asked about Gabe Driscoll's present frame of mind.
Bill said, "I haven't been in to see him this morning. Someone else took him breakfast."
Thatcher took a look around the room. It hadn't escaped others' notice that he and Bill were conferring privately, a privilege that Bill didn't afford everyone. Scotty and Harold tolerated Thatcher, but only to an extent. Most of the veterans of the department still regarded him with suspicion and hostility. He was sure that some held to the belief that he was guilty of doing something to Mila Driscoll. That continued to plague him. Whether or not they ever welcomed him into the fold, he had to lay that misconception to rest, which is why he wanted to speak to Bill alone.
"Let's go take a look at that road where the getaway car was waiting for the shooters."
"I doubt we'll find any clues."
"I doubt we will too, but I'm afraid these walls have ears."
Bill gave him a sharp look, then announced to the room at large that he would be back shortly. Laurel woke up later than usual with a fully risen sun lighting the bedroom through the shades Thatcher had lowered last night.
Thatcher.
At the mere thought of him, warm happiness suffused her. She was a bit disappointed that he hadn't stayed until she woke up, but she knew the hard day he had in store. At the same time, she was almost glad he wasn't facing her across the pillow just now. She blushed at the thought of ever looking him in the eye again. The things he'd taught her. Derby had regarded himself as quite a Casanova. His lovemaking had been vigorous, and he'd strutted that as a sign of his virility. He'd always taken for granted that she was satisfied, when the gratification had been his alone. The sex had been for him, not her. To be fair, she didn't believe he'd been selfish. He simply hadn't known any better. If not for Thatcher, neither would she. He had awakened her to levels of sensuality she'd never known were available or would have dreamed possible. In response to her apprehension over what he expected, over what she could expect from him, he'd been patient and persuasive. His touch, knowing smile, and whispered words had been temptation made manifest. His tenderness, passion sanctified. Throughout the night, he'd given her rapturous pleasure and had taken his. But in addition to the fervent lovemaking, he had also attended to her racked emotions. Without words, he'd held her close against him. Just that. His quietude had assuaged her grief over Davy's murder, her anxiety over Mike's condition, her distress over the unknown future. That thought prickled something at the back of her mind, some revelatory thought. But it had been fleeting, as elusive as the glimmer of a single firefly in a dark wood. Once, when she was a young girl, she'd chased a lightning bug through the woods that bordered her daddy's cotton field. It had flickered only one time, but she'd been certain she'd seen it, not imagined it. She'd plunged after it in the hope of catching it to put in a jar near her bed. She'd darted through the trees and underbrush, had run in circles, until she had exhausted herself and had given up the chase in defeat. She felt as frustrated and downcast now not to have netted that flash of clarity. It had been meaningful enough to give her instant pause, to raise goosebumps on her arms. She closed her eyes, lay perfectly still, and strained to recapture it. But try as she might, she couldn't. It had retreated into the recesses of her subconscious. Maybe it would show itself at another time, probably in a moment when she wasn't searching for it. Having been lazy long enough, she forced herself to get up. She washed and dressed and was pinning up her hair when she heard the back door open and the scrape of footsteps in the kitchen. Her heart swelled. Maybe Thatcher had come back for a good morning kiss after all. More probably, though, it was Irv, returning from the stills. She dreaded having to tell him, Corinne, and Ernie about the O'Connors, but she also hoped that they hadn't heard the dreadful news from someone else first. She pushed the last pin into her hair and then started downstairs, calling as she went, "Irv?" Once in Bill's car and on their way, Thatcher asked after Mrs. Amos.
"Not doing good, I hate to say. I'm worried, Thatcher. No ordinary bellyache lasts this long. With all these crises going on, if I can't take time off to get her to a doctor, I'm going to ask her friend to take her."
"What about Dr. Perkins?"
"He'd just give her more drops. She needs to be examined by somebody born after the Civil War. Have you heard of that sanitarium in Temple?"
Thatcher shook his head.
"Couple of doctors down there, names are Scott and White, are building quite a reputation. I may look into getting her in down there."
They drove along the road where Thatcher had last seen the getaway car's taillights disappearing around a bend. Bill drove beyond that point, then pulled his car to the side of the road.
"This is pointless. What's on your mind?"
Thatcher said, "Have you sent anybody out to Pointer's Gap yet?"
"It was on my list of things to do today, but with the ambush, the fire, I haven't had the men to spare, and you'd have to go with them to show the way, so no."
"Have you arranged for a lawyer for Driscoll?"
"It's not a priority."
Bill's expectant expression prompted Thatcher to get on with it.
"This is going to sound like I'm beating around the bush, but bear with me."
The sheriff checked his pocket watch.
"It's a busy day. 5 minutes, Thatcher."
"Last night, when you dropped Laurel and me at her house, she was on the brink of a breakdown."
"Over Davy O'Connor?"
"Sure. But also, yesterday afternoon, she had an upsetting visit from Bernie Croft and Chester Landry."
"Let me guess. They wanted her to merge her business with theirs."
Thatcher said nothing. Bill waited a few seconds, then sighed with exasperation.
"They're bootleggers, Thatcher. They wouldn't have been interested in Mrs. Plummer's pie business."
"I'm not saying anything about her."
"You don't have to. I've known for years that old Irv dabbled. He didn't cause anybody trouble, so I looked the other way. Other moonshiners did too, because he didn't put too deep a dent in their market. But the lady has gotten everybody riled.
Croft and Landry, for sure.
She turned them down?
Again, Thatcher remained silent, but Bill nodded as though Thatcher had replied.
In return, they shut up her delivery boys.
At the scene of the ambush, Harold said to me that somebody had wanted to make a point. I think he was right. I think it was Croft.
What about Landry?
He was with Laurel when the shooting started, remember?
Now I do. I had asked her about it, but we got off on Mike O'Connor's condition, so I never received an answer. Was he a decoy, sent to keep her occupied while the O'Connors were being ambushed?
That's possible, I guess. But what Landry told Laurel was that he'd return to make her a better offer.
Behind Bernie's back? A double cross?
Landry is weaselly enough.
Oh, I agree. But are you suggesting that while he was negotiating with Mrs. Plummer, Bernie acted alone?
I don't think Landry is above removing somebody, but he wouldn't go about it like that. He wouldn't have made a spectacle.
Like the ambush.
And like a hell of a blaze.
Bill looked at him with raised brows.
Hiram's place?
Hennessy was in the IRA. They're famous for blowing things up. They make explosive devices out of tin cans. That fire at the Johnson's place might not have been sparked by lightning.
Christ, Thatcher. Do you have any idea of the shit you're wading into here? Bernie Croft isn't a man you trifle with.
No, Bill. You can't trifle. You gotta hit him with more than a slap on the hand. You gotta kick him in the balls and then cut them off.
Bill lapsed into thought, tugging at the corner of his mustache.
We'd have a hell of a time proving that Bernie ordered that ambush or the fire. He's got loyal toadies. They would never give him up.
They'd hang first?
I would.
Thatcher looked at him, stunned.
You think I'm a coward? I guess I am, he said ruefully. But it's not my skin I'm concerned about. Daisy's life is the bargaining chip Bernie holds over me. That's why I don't buck him, Thatcher. He doesn't even have to carry out his veiled threats. It's the fear that he will that keeps me, everybody, from crossing him beyond a certain point.
Thatcher turned his head forward and stared through the grimy windshield.
Maybe he carries out more threats than you know of. I told you this would sound like beating around the bush.
And time's winding down.
Who told us about Pointer's Gap?
What's that got to do with
who, Bill?
The answer being obvious, Thatcher continued without pause.
Why did Croft drop that out-of-the-way place into the conversation? Like he just happened to think of it while explaining Driscoll's lust for Norma Blanchard.
Which we already knew about.
Yes, but Croft didn't know we knew. He made certain we did.
Bernie has been Gabe's advocate. Why would he plant in our minds the notion that Gabe could have assaulted Norma?
He did more than that, Thatcher said. He beat us over the head with it. Makes me wonder why.
57. When Thatcher and Bill returned to the sheriff's department, it was still a beehive of activity. As soon as Bill came through the door, a dozen written messages were handed to him. He scanned the notes, then delegated various tasks to his deputies and staff. Scotty approached and said under his breath, "The governor himself called this time."
If he calls back, put him off. Tell him.
And the Texas Rangers are here.
Bill snorted.
Well, that was to be expected. Actually, I'm glad to have them. How many?
Two.
Where are they?
Having a meal over at the cafe. Said they'd be back in 30 minutes.
How long ago was that?
Scotty checked the wall clock. 27 minutes ago. Bill turned to Thatcher.
Do you want to wait to confront Driscoll until we have more time?
Do you?
By way of an answer, Bill said to Scotty,
When the Rangers come back, tell them we're trying to squeeze a confession out of a prisoner and ask them to cool their heels a while longer.
The governor?
Suggest he have a drink.
Bill pushed open the door leading into the cell block. Thatcher followed him and closed the door behind them. Driscoll was fit to be tied.
Where is my lawyer? What the hell is going on out there? It sounds like a carnival. I've been yelling for someone to get in here, but I've been ignored.
Glaring at Thatcher, his voice went shrill.
And why is he still wearing a badge when he should be in here instead of me?
In contrasting calmness, Bill said,
Because he's not a murder suspect, Gabe.
I did not attack Norma. I would never have done that.
No, we don't think you did. The patients on your rural route vouched for your whereabouts during the time frame when she was assaulted.
Then why am I still locked up?
Because you killed Mila, didn't you?
No.
He gave an obstinate shake of his head.
Did you plan it with Norma, or did you act alone?
I did not kill my wife.
Disregarding the denial, Bill said,
I think Mrs. Driscoll's body was in the car with you when you went to Lefty's. Eleanor Wise just missed you loading it because you had parked around back.
Up till then, Thatcher had let Bill do all the talking. Now he said, I can't figure the murder weapon.
Good point, Gabe said tightly. Sheriff, are you listening? What did you use, Hutton?
Unfazed, Thatcher said, No obvious weapon was found inside the house. Either you used something commonplace that wouldn't be considered a weapon, or you took the weapon with you and tossed it somewhere along the way to Lefty's, or you buried it with Mrs. Driscoll's body at Pointer's Gap.
I didn't!
And why Pointer's Gap? Thatcher continued. It's rugged country.
You would know, wouldn't you? Driscoll sneered. You took Mila from our house that night and took her out there?
In what, Gabe?
His head swiveled back to Bill.
What?
Thatcher was on foot. How would he have gotten her out there?
Before the doctor could respond, Thatcher picked back up. Why did you choose Pointer's Gap?
I didn't. I've never even been there.
What about the picnics with your wife?
Driscoll looked at Bill.
What is he talking about?
The picnics, Thatcher said, bringing Driscoll's attention back to him. The ones you and Mrs. Driscoll went on at Pointer's Gap.
That's absurd. First of all, I hate picnics. Where did you even get a crazy idea like that?
Thatcher waited a beat, then said quietly,
From Bernie Croft.
The doctor looked like he'd been struck with a 2x4 right between the eyes. He gaped at Thatcher for a 10 count, then took several short, shallow breaths.
Bernie told you that?
Closely monitoring Driscoll's every reaction, Thatcher left it to Bill to explain how they'd come to hear about Pointer's Gap, when and where their seemingly casual conversation with the mayor had taken place.
To aid us in our investigation into the assault on Miss Blanchard, Bernie felt compelled to mention your affair with her, and then your earnest attempt to atone for it by paying more attention to your wife.
Gabe was swallowing convulsively. Bill went on.
His offhanded mention of Pointer's Gap.
It wasn't offhanded,
Driscoll blurted. He slumped forward against the bars, clutching two of them to help himself remain upright.
It was his idea.
What was his idea?
He remained silent and gave a mournful shake of his head.
It was Bernie's idea to do what, Gabe? Say it.
I can't. He'll kill me.
Thatcher leaned in and whispered to him,
If you betray Croft, he may very well kill you. But if you don't come clean, you have me to be scared of.
Gabe looked at him with fright. Thatcher gazed back, unblinking. The doctor was quick to yield. He turned to Bill and stammered,
Bernie took care of the body for me. He had men meet me at Lefty's. They took Mila.
Was she dead, Gabe?
He nodded.
You killed her?
Yes.
He lowered his head and began to cry. Thatcher backed away from the bars, separating them. He exchanged a glance with Bill. They'd gotten the confession they'd been after, but having Mila Driscoll's fate confirmed was a dismal triumph.
How'd you kill her, Gabe?
Bill asked softly. Just then, Scotty came barging through the door at the end of the corridor.
Sheriff?
Not now, Bill said.
It's...
Not now.
It's Mrs. Amos.
Bill spun around to his deputy. Scotty spoke so hastily, he tripped over his words.
Her friend Mrs. Cantor called, says Mrs. Amos is in pain, something awful. Her stomach, said it might have been a whiskey, said she caught her with a bottle of bourbon, half empty.
Jesus. Bill looked at Thatcher. I have to go.
And the Rangers are back,
Scotty added.
Screw them. Stay with Driscoll,
Bill said to Thatcher.
Get it all on paper. Have him sign.
Wait! Your wife has severe stomach pains after drinking bourbon?
Gabe had stopped crying, but had turned whey-faced, and his lips were rubbery.
He said it was for the Johnsons.
In a matter of seconds, Bill had the cell door unlocked, had grabbed Driscoll by the throat, and had backed him against the wall.
Who said? Bernie?
Driscoll gave a wobbly nod.
Said what was for the Johnsons?
Bill shook him, thumping him hard against the wall.
What?
Arsenic. In the bourbon.
With the regard one would give a rag doll, Bill dragged the doctor from the cell and pushed him down the hallway with the unstoppable propulsion of a cowcatcher. Scotty had come along. He was with Bill as he burst through the front door of his house, shouting his wife's name. By the time Thatcher had towed Driscoll from the car, up the walk, and into the house, Bill was on the landing, barging past a middle-aged woman who was wringing her hands with anxiety and saying repeatedly,
I don't know what to do for her.
Scotty hung back to explain the circumstances.
It'll be all right, Mrs. Cantor. We've brought Dr. Driscoll.
Thatcher, with a grip on the back of Driscoll's collar, pushed him up the stairs and into the bedroom. Bill was seated on the side of the bed, bending over his wife, who was writhing in apparent agony. She reached out and clutched Bill's hand.
I think I'm dying.
You're not going to die.
He raised her hand and kissed the back of it, hard.
You are not going to die. I'm going to fix it.
He left the bed, walked over to Driscoll, drew his pistol, and pressed the barrel of it against the doctor's forehead.
If she doesn't survive this, I am killing you first, then Bernie Croft.
Gastric lavage, Driscoll said.
What?
Pump her stomach. I need to pump her stomach with salt water. I'll need my equipment.
Describe it.
Thatcher was amazed by how suddenly Driscoll slipped into professional mode. In seemingly perfect control, he gave Scotty a description of the tubing device he required and told him in which cabinet it was stored in his office.
But the house is locked.
Kick the damn door in. Shoot out the lock, Bill said to his deputy.
Scotty rushed out and thumped down the stairs. Daisy groaned pitiably and extended her hand toward Bill, who holstered his pistol but shouted to Driscoll,
Do something now!
The doctor shrugged off his coat.
We need to induce vomiting.
She's been vomiting for days.
But she hadn't ingested half a bottle all at once. This is acute. We need to induce vomiting.
He rolled up his shirt sleeves.
Where can I wash?
Across the hall.
Thatcher followed him as far as the door to the bathroom and watched as he lathered up and rinsed his hands. As he was drying them, his gaze met Thatcher's in the mirror above the sink.
Are you expecting an apology for my false accusations, Mr. Hutton?
I don't give a fucking hell about an apology from you, but you owe your wife one. How'd you do it?
I hit her on the back of the head with an iron skillet, the skillet in which she baked the shortbread you enjoyed so much.
He folded the hand towel and hung it just so on the metal bar, then went past Thatcher and returned to the bedroom. Daisy was lying on her side, knees pulled to her chest, moaning and gripping her midsection. Bill was leaning over her, stroking her face and talking softly. Thatcher noticed a half-full bottle of name-brand bourbon sitting on the bureau. He went over and got it, knowing it would be valuable evidence against both Driscoll and Croft. As he left the bedroom unnoticed, Bill was holding back his beloved's hair as she retched into a basin held by the man who had poisoned her, at the direction of Bernie Croft.
Bernie said,
Hello, Gert.
Ain't you heard? We're shut down.
good as, anyway.
I'd like to talk to you.
We'll talk when you get the law off my back.
In due time.
Due time, she said scornfully. No more graft, you hear me?
I'll get you back to normal soon.
You've been saying that, but in the meanwhile, Bill Amos is having our road patrolled nightly. All that attention is keeping away customers, too scared of being caught in another raid. Much longer and we won't have any hooch to sell, 'cause Lefty's drinking it all up. Stays drunk, ain't no use to me. No pussy to sell neither, 'cause all them twats upstairs has sneaked off one by one. Took their inspiration from that Corinne, I guess. I'm losing money by the hour, and you're doing nothing but taking up space, Mr. Mayor.
He smiled.
I'm here to make it up to you, Gert.
She honked a laugh.
Ain't likely. Everybody knows you look after your own self.
This benefits us both.
She squinted at him through an exhalation of cigarette smoke.
What does?
I brought you a present.
He turned. Hennessy was standing at the side of the town car. At a signal from Bill, he opened the back door and pulled a bound and gagged woman from the car. Croft said to Gert,
I believe you're acquainted with Mrs. Plummer.
Laurel had gone into the kitchen, expecting to find her father-in-law rummaging for the makings of breakfast. Instead, Bernie Croft had been rifling through her recipe box. Fanning one of the cards at her, he'd greeted her pleasantly.
Good morning, Mrs. Plummer.
This lemon chess pie sounds delicious.
And then from behind her, a heavy hand had been clamped over her mouth, at the same time an arm as strong as an iron band had encircled her waist. She'd raked her nails across the hand over her mouth and knew by the profanities grunted near her ear that she'd drawn blood, or at least had caused pain. She'd struggled and kicked, but she'd been held fast while Croft had tied her hands behind her with a thin but sturdy cord that dug into her flesh. The hand over her mouth had been removed and replaced by a handkerchief, which had caused her to gag. She'd been carried to the long black car she'd seen parked in front of her house the day before. She'd been thrust into the back seat, no doubt by the burly chauffeur. Croft had climbed in beside her. They could have been out for a Sunday drive, for all the attention she paid him, until they'd made the turnoff to Lefty's. She'd looked at him then, and his chuckle had been villainous. Or perhaps it had only sounded that way to her because she knew him to be a villain. When they'd reached the roadhouse, Croft and Hennessy had gotten out. Croft had gone to the door, which had been answered by Gert. After a brief conversation, Croft had signaled Hennessy to get her from the car and bring her forward. Now, upon seeing her, Gert stepped out onto the porch. She flicked her cigarette into the dirt and clapped her hands together.
Well, I'd be damned. You really did bring me a present, Bernie. It ain't even my birthday.
Laurel dug her heels in, kicked against the chauffeur's shins, twisted and turned her body, did anything she could think of to make his job more difficult. She didn't delude herself into thinking she could escape someone of his size, but she refused to meekly cooperate. When they reached the porch steps, Croft instructed Hennessy to pat down her skirt pockets.
Already did there in her kitchen.
He had, but with a sinking heart, Laurel had known he would come up empty, and he had. Irv would never let her hear the last of it, if she lived through this.
Search again, Croft said now. Right pocket. Yesterday I saw her patting at it. Giveaway habit.
Hennessy did as told, even shoving his hands into her pockets and digging deep.
Nothing, boss.
Gert snickered.
Try her garters.
Laurel looked defiantly at Croft as he motioned for his muscle man to do as suggested. Hennessy knelt in front of her and ran his hands up and down both legs, higher than her garters. Being groped by him was a desecration of Thatcher's caresses. She wanted to scream. As Hennessy came to his feet, he grinned at her.
Nothing but smooth skin.
She forced herself not to react, either to his molestation or disgusting leer. Croft then hitched his chin at Hennessy, who pushed her lower spine hard enough to knock her off balance. She fell forward onto the lowest porch step. Without her hands free to catch herself, she landed on her elbow. Pain sizzled up her arm and into her shoulder. She couldn't cry out for the handkerchief in her mouth. Even had she been able to, she wouldn't have given this trio of degenerates the satisfaction.
"No call for rough stuff, Hennessy," Croft said. "Yet."
He reached down and helped Laurel to her feet and guided her up the steps. But once they reached the porch, she yanked her arm free of his deceptively solicitous grip. He took the white linen handkerchief from her mouth. It was monogrammed with his initials. Feeling her saliva on it, he frowned with distaste. She would have liked to spit in his eye, but reasoned that at this point, her best defense was to show as little reaction as possible. But while her features remained composed and indifferent, she was quaking on the inside. No one knew where she was. Not Irv, Thatcher, no one. Croft raised a hand to shade his eyes.
"Gert, let's take her inside. Get her and her delicate skin out of this sun. We wouldn't want her to burn."
Gert gave a phlegmy laugh as she pulled open the squeaky screen door.
"Of course not. Wouldn't want that to happen."
Hennessy stayed outside. The room was as Laurel remembered, cavernous, dim, and hazy with cigarette smoke. There was no sign of Lefty. Only an ominous silence came from upstairs. The shotgun lay on the bar. Gert walked over to it, sat down on a stool, and lit a fresh cigarette as though settling in for the floor show. Laurel realized she was it. Croft pushed her into a chair, then dragged one over, stationed it directly in front of her, and sat down.
"Mrs. Plummer, can I call you Laurel? Where is Chester Landry?"
Of all the things he could have said, that question was the least expected. Gert must have thought the same. She came off her stool with a thud.
"Chester Landry, my ass! Ask her where my girl's at! Soon's I find that scheming little bitch, I'm gonna wring her neck and let Miss High Horse here watch while I do it."
Croft acted as though he hadn't heard her and remained focused on Laurel.
"Where was Landry headed when he slunk off last night?"
Laurel laughed.
"You could have asked me that without going to all this elaborate trouble."
"Then tell me where he is."
"I have no earthly idea."
He sighed. Then, with shocking alacrity and force, he backhanded her across the face. 58. Following the stomach-pumping procedure, Daisy Amos was resting more comfortably. Thatcher knew Bill hated leaving her side and resuming his duties, but he was hard-pressed to do so on this of all days, when three major investigations demanded attention and action. He asked Thatcher to escort the doctor downstairs to the parlor where he would soon join them.
"Put these on him."
He produced a pair of handcuffs. Bill remained in the foyer with Scotty, who had been communicating with headquarters by telephone. He reported that the two Texas Rangers had divided up. One was getting information from the deputies who'd investigated the scene of the ambush. The other had gone to the Johnson homestead to assess the devastation there in advance of the arrival of the arson specialists. Thatcher overheard Bill ask Scotty to locate Bernie Croft.
"Don't approach him. Don't indicate that you're looking for him. Just let me know where he is. Me and me only."
"Yes, sir." The deputy left.
When Bill entered the parlor, Driscoll said,
"I hope you can trust Mrs. Amos's friend to make her drink the water I prepared."
He'd added honey to a large pitcher of water and had left it on the bedside table.
"Even if she continues to throw up for a time, she needs the water. It will help flush the arsenic from her system naturally through urination. I've heard that the honey helps, chemically, somehow. Also eggs. She should be fed eggs. The sulfur in them—"
Bill interrupted him.
"You told Alice all that. I'm confident she'll follow your instructions to the letter."
Driscoll held up his cuffed hands.
"Are these necessary?"
"They were for Thatcher when he was suspected of the crime you've confessed to. They stay on. You poisoned my wife."
"Bernie brought two cases of liquor to my office and left them to be spiked with a slow-working poison, so it wouldn't be immediately noticed.
He told me those bottles were to be gifts for members of the Johnson family. I had no way of knowing that Mrs. Amos would be allotted some, too.
Bill had admitted to Thatcher, during his tell-all on the porch, that Croft was Daisy's supplier of bootleg whiskey. That he'd given her bottles spiked with arsenic was indicative of the malice he felt toward Bill, as well as Daisy, for choosing Bill over him.
"Is she still in danger?" Bill was asking Driscoll. "And you had better not bullshit me."
"The arsenic will remain in her system, but for how long depends on a number of factors. That's why I emphasize flushing it out and neutralizing it as much as possible."
"Could she still die of it?"
"It can cause complications, organ damage and so forth, that can eventually prove fatal. It's a toxin, after all. Had I not acted so swiftly and given her the lavage, more than likely she would have succumbed."
To Thatcher, Driscoll was a complete mystery. He was like the doctor in that book. Two men with opposing personalities living inside the same body. One minute, Driscoll was bawling like a child, caught misbehaving. The next, he was calm, detached, even defiant. Within an hour, the man had admitted to poisoning bottles of liquor he knew would be consumed by human beings and had confessed to murdering his wife and unborn baby. Thatcher rather agreed with Patsy Kemp, who'd said with bitterness, "They ought to hang the bastard twice." Bill was now asking Driscoll why he had agreed to poison the bourbon.
"Bernie had me over a barrel."
He poured out the whole sordid story about Croft trying to recruit him to transport booze on his rural route.
"I was offended. I'm a physician, not a bootlegger."
He looked down at his linked fingers.
"But then, the night Mila, when I needed Bernie to see me through that crisis, he did so. He and that old bag at Lefty's quickly set up the incident with the prostitute, so I would have a cover story for leaving the house at that hour of the night."
"Did Gert know about Mila?" Bill asked.
"I don't believe so. Bernie said she was a whore at heart and wouldn't ask questions so long as she was paid."
He sighed deeply.
"Anyway, after that night, he owned me, body and soul. I was subjected to a lot of humiliation from him. I tolerated it, believing I had no other choice. But when I found out that he'd told Norma about Pointer's Gap, I..."
"What?" Bill held up his hand. "Run that past us again."
"Norma knew about Mila. She sprang it on me the afternoon she brought Arthur to the house. I was floored, flabbergasted. Bernie was the only person who could have told her, except for the men who actually buried the body, and they were all Mexicans who didn't even speak English. I had trusted Bernie to keep the secret. We'd made a pact. When I learned that he'd told Norma, I accosted him on the street."
He described a volatile encounter in an alleyway.
"I was livid."
Thatcher sat forward and placed his forearms on his thighs.
"You were livid. What about Croft?"
"Smug. He said I was naive to think that he wouldn't have held some collateral for doing me such a huge favor. I told him that Norma was using it to pressure me into marriage. He agreed that people would become suspicious if she and I married too soon, and that Norma should be made to understand that. He offered to speak to her on my behalf, but I told him I would handle it. I hadn't gotten around to it."
Thatcher looked over at Bill, who, like him, appeared to have realized the significance of Bernie Croft's offer to impress understanding upon Norma Blanchard. Bill stood and pulled Driscoll out of his chair.
"Just so we understand one another, Gabe, if Daisy gets well, you'll stand trial and be judged by a jury of your peers. If she succumbs, you won't live to see trial."
Driscoll jerked his arm free.
"There's gratitude for you. I saved your wife's life and you repay me by issuing threats? First him," he said, looking at Thatcher with scorn. "Now you. Isn't it against the law to threaten a suspect in your custody? Doesn't that violate a lawman's code of ethics?"
"I don't give a damn."
Bill hauled off and slammed his fist into Gabe's face. He fell backward and landed on the floor, out cold. There was one knock on the front door before Scotty pushed it open and walked in. He looked down at Driscoll. What happened?
He was trying to escape, Bill said. When you get him back to the jail, put him in shackles, too. What about our mayor?
That's what I came to tell you. I know where he's at.
What I think? We ought to go into town and check on her.
We heard you the first dozen times you said that.
Corinne gave Irv a malevolent squint.
Well, apparently you ain't listening, old man. Miss Laurel said if she didn't come tomorrow, which was yesterday, she'd come the next day, which is today.
Day ain't over, is it?
Ernie looked up at the sun.
Noon or better, but she has a point, Irv.
Oh, you're just horny. You'd agree with anything she said,
Irv grumbled, shooting a glower toward Corinne.
You said yourself you was scared Miss Laurel would come to grief, she said. Didn't he say that, Ernie?
Ernie tugged on his long earlobe.
Seems I do recollect.
I remember saying it, Irv snapped, and I still hold to it. But you, he said to Corinne, agreed that we should lay low till we got the all clear. Laurel wouldn't want us to show ourselves till it was safe. We've got no idea what all went on last night. I doubt much did on account of that storm, but still.
Corinne stood and dusted off her seat.
Well, you can sit here till you become a fossil, like in them rocks over yonder. I'm going.
She marched off toward Irv's truck, which they'd camouflaged with cedar boughs.
How are you going to get there?
He called after her.
You can't drive.
She started pulling the cedar branches off the truck and slinging them aside.
I can drive good enough. Ernie's been teaching me.
Irv turned an accusatory look on his friend. Ernie guiltily raised his bony shoulders.
In my spare time.
Hell's bells.
Irv started after Corinne.
I'll drive us.
Over his shoulder, he said to Ernie,
You stay and guard the place. Don't do no cooking till we get back, and keep those firearms within your reach.
Y'all be careful.
Bill instructed Scotty to return Driscoll to the jail, leave a man there to guard him, then to bring a carload of deputies to Lefty's. He also ordered Scotty not to leave town without obtaining an arrest warrant for Mayor Bernard Croft. Looking dubious, Scotty asked how the sheriff planned on arranging that.
I'm calling the judge now.
Scotty left with Driscoll, who had regained consciousness. His shouted protests over being treated inhumanely were ignored. Bill placed a call. Thatcher overheard him threatening a judge to expose both his bribe-taking and the mistress he kept in Stephenville if he didn't have the warrant ready by the time Scotty got to the courthouse to pick it up. After completing the call, Bill went upstairs to check on Mrs. Amos. He didn't stay long.
She's better. Sleeping,
he told Thatcher as they left the house. Less than 5 minutes after Scotty's announcement that Bernie Croft had been seen heading for Lefty's, the sheriff and Thatcher were speeding toward it, having no idea if their quarry was still there. Croft's notable town car, with Hennessy behind the wheel, had been spotted taking the turnoff to Lefty's by a deputy who'd come off guard duty at the Johnsons' property and was on his way back into town. Bill took the turnoff now, but didn't go far off the highway before stopping. As he checked his pistol to make sure it was loaded, he said,
I'm waiting for that warrant.
I'll reconnoiter.
Having checked his own Colt, Thatcher clicked the cylinder back into place and opened the passenger door.
Just in case I don't come back, that poison bottle of bourbon is in your kitchen cabinet behind a box of oatmeal.
Only you would think of that right now.
Could make the difference in a verdict.
He hooked Barker's rifle onto his shoulder by the strap.
Take these, too.
Bill passed Thatcher a pair of binoculars. Thatcher recognized them as army issue and looked at Bill, who said,
They were among Tim's effects.
Thatcher left the car door ajar and jogged over to the trees that bordered the road. They were sparse, providing only marginal cover as he moved among them. The sun was high and hot. Last night's rain steamed up from the spongy ground. Thatcher was breathing heavily by the time the roof of the roadhouse came into view. He proceeded in a crouch. Still about 100 yards away from the building, he spotted Croft's auto parked in front. A boulder provided him an advantageous spot from which to take a closer look. Situating himself behind the outcropping, he propped his elbows on it and looked through the binoculars. He wasn't surprised to see Hennessy leaning against the front fender of Croft's car, smoking a cigarette. He whisked a fly off his face. He took a handkerchief from his pants pocket and wiped the back of his neck with it. He turned once and looked behind him down the road. Seeing nothing, he faced the building again. Thatcher focused the binoculars on the screened entrance and then on each of the front windows, but could see nothing through any of them. He watched for a couple more minutes. Nothing happened. He was about to turn away and return to report to Bill when the screen door was pushed open and Gert appeared. She called out something to Hennessy. Thatcher didn't catch her words, but the former IRA fighter responded immediately by tossing away his cigarette and climbing the steps to go inside. Laurel had lost track of time under the barrage of Croft's questions, few of which she knew the answers to. He didn't believe that, so he continued relentlessly. He hadn't hit her again, but the threat of his doing so filled her with dread. Her ears were still ringing. The side of her face throbbed. She could feel it swelling. The blow had also fueled her contempt. She took pride in knowing that the only way the Honorable Mayor Croft had managed to subdue her was to strike her while her hands were bound. Some big man he was. He never raised his voice. He ignored Gert's snorts of derision over his going too easy on her. At her suggestion that she take a whack at Laurel, Croft had said, "I don't want her dead."
"I ain't gonna kill her till she tells me where she's hid that girl. She ain't reappeared at the shack."
"You see, Laurel?"
Croft spoke with the dulcet tone and phony smile of a public official making a campaign promise.
"If you'll just tell us what we want to know, we can end this unpleasantness."
"What you'll end is me."
She feared she wouldn't live out this day, but she didn't know the answers to Croft's questions about Chester Landry. Why would he think she would? And she would never give Corinne over to Gert. Croft asked her the same questions repeatedly. Her answers never varied, but she began replying with mounting hostility. With her hands bound behind her, and Gert's evident affection for her shotgun, Laurel didn't have any means of fighting back except to show her loathing and defiance of both of them.
"Let's try one more time, Laurel," Croft said. "Landry went behind my back and offered to form a partnership with you, didn't he?"
"No."
"You've admitted that he returned to your house last night."
"Yes, but our conversation was interrupted by gunshots. We ran to the scene of the ambush. From there, he disappeared. I've told you this a dozen times."
Brazenly, she asked,
"Did you have Davy O'Connor killed?"
Ignoring that, he said,
"You never saw Landry again?"
"No."
"He just ran away?"
"Yes."
"He didn't say where he was off to?"
"No. If you ordered my friend's execution, may God damn you," she yelled.
"Landry didn't lure you into a business arrangement that excluded me?"
"He couldn't have lured me into anything. He was slimy. I wanted nothing to do with either of you. If you want to know his whereabouts, go in search of him and stop wasting your time with me. I can't tell you something that I don't know."
Croft sighed theatrically and looked over at Gert.
"Get Hennessy."
Those two words caused Laurel's stomach to lurch, but she kept her expression impassive as the man came inside and took up a position to the left of and slightly behind Croft. Laurel didn't acknowledge that he was there, didn't dare to look at him, not wanting to see on his ugly face either a fearsome threat or a taunting smile that would remind her of his groping hands. Croft gave Hennessy a sidelong glance, then, when he came back around, slapped Laurel hard enough to knock her chair backward. Her head hit the floor with a crack. Hennessy stepped around, jerked her to her feet, righted the chair, firmly planted it in front of Croft, and pushed her down into it. Croft's arrogant face swam into her vision through tears of pain and fury.
"One last time," he said softly. Where is Chester Landry?
Go to hell.
He heaved another sigh and gave her the look of a disappointed parent.
Since you're resistant to my rough handling, perhaps you'll be more receptive to Mr. Hennessy's sweet talk.
He waited a beat before smiling and adding,
upstairs.
Thatcher made his way back to where Bill was waiting. He got there just as a car bearing the sheriff's office insignia pulled off the highway and rolled to a stop behind Bill's car. Scotty, Harold, and three others got out. All were heavily armed with shotguns, rifles, and handguns. Bill motioned for them to gather around Thatcher so he could brief them on what he'd observed.
I only saw Gert and Hennessy, but Croft is bound to be in there.
No indication of what was going on inside? Bill asked.
No, I couldn't get close enough to hear anything without being seen. It was quiet, though, no ruckus.
Bill asked Scotty for the warrant and placed it in his breast pocket. He addressed Harold and one of the other deputies.
You two set up a roadblock. Don't let anyone get past you, either going in or coming out.
They nodded understanding.
Scotty and you other two, approach the house on foot. Flank it, cover the back. Stay in the trees and out of sight unless hell breaks loose. Thatcher and I will approach from the front in my car.
As Bill continued giving instructions, Thatcher took off his suit coat, rolled it up, and placed it on the floorboard of Bill's car. He didn't want anything between him and his holster, which he tied to his thigh. Those in the group noticed and exchanged looks among themselves. Thatcher ignored the suspicion and resentment still directed at him, but Bill must have sensed it. He said,
Gabe Driscoll has confessed to killing his wife. He alleges that Bernie Croft arranged to have her buried out at Pointer's Gap. Thatcher was wronged.
To a man, they shifted their gazes to him, but he gave a small shrug and kept his attention on Bill.
Okay, then, the sheriff said, as though a weighty matter had been settled. We'll try to peacefully serve the warrant, he said, but I don't expect Bernie to surrender without a fight. Thatcher, anything to add to what you've already told us of the situation?
Yeah, Croft's man Hennessy is no amateur. Given the chance, he'll kill you. If you get into it with him, don't hesitate. Put him down.
They acknowledged the advice with grim nods.
Bill said, All right, let's go.
Who's that?
One of the deputies said. They all turned. Irv Plummer's truck was rattling like a peddler's wagon up the road. It came to a stop behind the second department vehicle. Bill swore,
Get him out of here.
But before anyone could act, Corinne hopped down from the passenger seat and came running toward Thatcher.
Mr. Hutton, what's going on?
We're serving an arrest warrant.
For Gert?
She turned to Bill.
I hope it's for Gert.
Not today.
Fair warning, y'all. She keeps a loaded shotgun on the bar within reach.
Looking past Corinne, Bill said,
Mr. Plummer, you can't be here.
It's a public road?
Not now, it's not.
Irv, you need to get going, Thatcher said.
Oh, you think that badge gives you the right to order me around?
Take it up with me later, Irv, for right now, get Corinne and clear out.
Irv looked around at the group of solemn men and the firepower they carried and seemed to grasp the seriousness of the situation. He said to Thatcher,
The girl saw the marked cars, insisted on turning in and finding out if Gert was finally going to get her comeuppance. But I see y'all got business, so we'll be on our way. Come on, girl.
He put his hand in the crook of Corinne's elbow. She shook him off, saying,
What the hell's he doing?
They all followed her line of sight. Lefty was staggering out from a grove of mesquite trees. Seeing them, he stopped. Swaying on his feet, he slowly and unsteadily raised his hands in surrender.
I had no part in it. Didn't want no part in it.
The two deputies closest to him took him by his skinny arms and half-dragged, half-carried him over to the group.
Swear to God, it was none of my doing.
His protruding Adam's apple slid up and down.
I sneaked out the back whilst they were occupied.
His knees gave out, and he would have gone to the ground if the deputies hadn't been supporting him.
I'm kinda drunk.
Bill said sternly, Well, you've got 1 second to sober up. What's going on back there? What don't you want any part of?
I'm scared, for it's over, they're gonna kill her.
Who?
He rolled his eyes and finally blinked Irv into focus.
His daughter-in-law. Ain't that why all y'all are here?
59. Thatcher waited for no one. He tossed the rifle into the back of Bill's car, got behind the wheel, and thanks to the electric starter, was already accelerating by the time Bill had caught hold of the open passenger door. He stood on the running board until he could clamber into the seat. Scotty shouted, All hell is broken loose! He and the other two deputies sprinted after the car, grasped whatever handhold they could get, and hopped onto the running boards. Thatcher was merciless on the motor. He didn't spare the tires either, making no attempt to dodge rain-filled potholes. When the roadhouse came into sight, he aimed the hood of Bill's car at the rear end of Croft's town car. As he braked behind it, mere inches away from colliding with it, the deputies leaped off and divided up as Bill had instructed them to. Scotty took off toward the left side of the building, the other two went right. Thatcher pulled his pistol and hurdled the front steps, then flattened himself to one side of the screened door.
Laurel! No answer.
Bill made it to the porch and stationed himself on the other side of the door.
Bernie! We know you have Mrs. Plummer. Send her out unharmed.
Nothing.
I have a warrant for your arrest, Bernie.
From within, Croft laughed.
That's hilarious.
Bill said, You're right. Let's skip the official stuff. Save taxpayers the money of trying you for the murder of Davy O'Connor and the arson murder of the Johnsons. I'll simply kill you for poisoning Daisy.
There was no response, and Thatcher was done fucking around. He signaled to Bill that he would open the screen door, since it opened out toward them, and he was on the left side. Bill nodded. Thatcher reached for the handle and flung open the door toward Bill. Thatcher hit the ground and rolled across the threshold. He was greeted by 2 shotgun blasts. Gert must have fired both barrels. Thatcher registered that she would need time to reload. Bill must have had the same thought as he came through the opening with his pistol blazing. He drew fire from 2 positions, behind the bar and from above. Thatcher looked up. Hennessy was on the landing at the top of the stairs, holding Laurel in front of him, one hand clamped over her mouth, the other aiming a pistol at Thatcher. Don't hesitate. Put him down. Sooner than Thatcher could think it, he fired at the bridge of Hennessy's nose. The man showed an instant of surprise, then fell back, dead before he hit the floor. But when he released Laurel, she went somersaulting down the stairs. Thatcher realized her hands were bound. He shouted her name, but got no answer. A bullet struck the floor within an inch of his face, sending up splintered wood. A chunk hit him on the cheekbone, barely.